How pressing is the risk? Enough, I think, to change thinking about human self-preservation fundamentally. The current state of the environment can be summarized thus. The global population is precariously large and will become much more so before peaking sometime after 2050. Humanity overall is improving per capita production, health, and longevity, but it is doing so by eating up the planet's capital, including natural resources and biological diversity millions of years old. Homo sapiens is approaching the limit of its food and water supply. Unlike any species that lived before, it is also changing the world's atmosphere and climate, lowering and polluting water tables, shrinking forests, and spreading deserts. Most of the stress originates directly or indirectly from a handful of industrialized countries. Their proven formulas for prosperity are being eagerly adopted by the rest of the world. The emulation cannot be sustained, not with the same levels of consumption and waste. Even if the industrialization of developing countries is only partly successful, the environmental aftershock will dwarf the population explosion that preceded it. Some will, of course, call this synopsis environmental alarmism. I earnestly wish that accusation were true. Unfortunately, it is the reality-grounded opinion of the overwhelming majority of statured scientists who study the environment. By statured scientists, I mean those who collect and analyze the data, build the theoretical models, interpret the results, and publish articles vetted for professional journals by other experts, often including their rivals. I do not mean by statured scientists the many journalists, talk show hosts, and think tank polemicists who also address the environment, even though their opinions reach a vastly larger audience. This is not to devalue their professions, which have separate high standards, only to suggest that there are better qualified sources to consult for factual information about the environment. Seen in this light, the environment is much less a controversial subject than suggested by routine coverage in the media. Consider, then, the assessment made through the mid-1990s by the statured scientists. Their quantitative estimates differ according to the mathematical assumptions and procedures variously used, but most still fall within limits from which trends can be projected with confidence. By 1997, the global population had reached 5.8 billion, growing at the rate of 90 million per year. In 1600, there were only about 500 million people on Earth, and in 1940, 2 billion. The amount of increase during the 1990s alone is expected to exceed the entire population alive in 1600. The global growth rate, after reaching a peak during the 1960s, has been dropping ever since. In 1963, for example, each woman bore an average of 4.1 children. In 1996, the number had declined to 2.6. In order to stabilize the world population, the number must be 2.1 children per woman, the extra 0.1 allowing for child mortality. Long-term population size is extremely sensitive to this replacement number, as shown by the following projections. If the number were 2.1, there would be 7.7 billion people on Earth in 2050, leveling off at 8.5 billion in 2150. If 2.0, the population would peak at 7.8 billion, then drop by 2150 to 5.6 billion, the total in the mid-1990s. If 2.2, it would reach 12.5 billion in 2050, 20.8 billion in 2150, and if 2.2 could miraculously be maintained thereafter, the human biomass would eventually equal the weight of the world and then, after a few millennia, expanding outward at the speed of light, it would exceed the mass of the visible universe. Even if the global birth rate were reduced drastically and immediately, say to the Chinese goal of one child per woman, the population would not peak for one or two generations. The overshoot is ensured by the disproportionate number of young people already in existence who look to long lives ahead. How many people can the world support for an indefinite period? Experts do not agree, but a majority put the number variously between 4 and 16 billion. The true number will depend on the quality of life that future generations are willing to accept. If everyone agreed to become vegetarian, leaving nothing for livestock, the present 1.4 billion hectares of arable land, 3.5 billion acres, would supply about 10 billion people. If humans utilized as food all the energy captured by plant photosynthesis, some 40 trillion watts, Earth could support about 16 billion people. From such a fragile world, almost all other life forms would have to be excluded. Even if, by force majeure, the population levels off at well under 10 billion by mid-century, the relatively extravagant lifestyle now enjoyed by the middle classes of North America, Western Europe, and Japan cannot be attained by most of the rest of the world. The reason is that the impact of each country on the environment is multiplicative. It is dependent, in a complex manner, on the formula called PAT, population size times per capita affluence, hence consumption, times a measure of the voracity of the technology used in sustaining consumption. The magnitude of PAT can be usefully visualized by the ecological footprint of productive land needed to support each member of the society with existing technology. In Europe, the footprint is 3.5 hectares. A hectare is 2.5 acres. In Canada, 4.3 hectares, and in the United States, 5 hectares. In most developing countries, it is less than half a hectare. To raise the whole world to the U.S. level with existing technology would require two more planet Earths. It matters little that North Dakota and Mongolia are mostly empty. It makes no difference that the 5.8 billion people in the world today could be log-stacked out of sight in a corner of the Grand Canyon. The datum of interest is the average footprint on productive land, which must somehow be lowered if significantly more people are to achieve a decent standard of living. To suppose that the living standard of the rest of the world can be raised to that of the most prosperous countries, with existing technology and current levels of consumption and waste, is a dream in pursuit of a mathematical impossibility. Even to level out present-day income inequities would require shrinking the ecological footprints of the prosperous countries. That is problematic in the market-based global economy, where the main players are also militarily the most powerful, and in spite of a great deal of rhetoric, largely indifferent to the suffering of others. Few people in industrialized countries are fully aware of how badly off the poor of the world really are. Roughly 1.3 billion people, more than a fifth of the world population, have cash incomes under $1 a day. The next tier of 1.6 billion earn $1 to $3. Somewhat more than 1 billion live in what the United Nations classifies as absolute poverty, uncertain of obtaining food from one day to the next. Each year, more than the entire population of Sweden, between 13 and 18 million, mostly children, die of starvation or the side effects of malnutrition or other poverty-related causes. In order to gain perspective, imagine the response if Americans and Europeans were told that in the coming year, the entire population of Sweden or Scotland and Wales combined, or New England, would die of poverty. Of course, the exemptionalists will say that new technology and the rising tide of the free market economy can solve the problem. The solution, they explain, is straightforward. Just use more land, fertilizer, and higher yield crops, and work harder to improve distribution. And, of course, encourage more education, technology transfer, and free trade. Oh, and discourage ethnic strife and political corruption. All that will certainly help, and should have high priority, but it cannot solve the main problem, which is the finite resources of planet Earth. It is true that only 11% of the world's land surface is under cultivation, but that already includes the most arable part. The bulk of the remaining 89% has limited use or none at all. Greenland, Antarctica, most of the vast northern taiga, and the equally vast ultra-dry deserts are not available. The remnant tropical forests and savannas can be cleared and planted, but at the cost of most of the species of plants and animals in the world with minor agricultural gain. Nearly half their expanse is underlaid by soils of low natural fertility. 42% of the untapped area of sub-Saharan Africa, for example, and 46% of that in Latin America. Meanwhile, cultivated and deforested lands are losing topsoil to erosion at 10 times the sustainable level. By 1989, 11% of the world's cropland had been classified by soil experts as severely degraded. From 1950 to the mid-1990s, the area of cropland per person fell by half, from 0.23 hectare to 0.12 hectare, less than a quarter the size of a soccer field. Widespread starvation was avoided because the Green Revolution during the same 40-year period boosted per hectare yield dramatically with new varieties of rice and other crops, better pesticide application, and increased use of fertilizer and irrigation. But even these technologies have limits. By 1985, the growth in yield slowed. That trend, when combined with the relentless growth of population, initiated a decline in per capita production. The shortfall first became apparent in the developing countries, whose grain self-sufficiency fell from 96% in 1969 to 1971 at the height of the Green Revolution to 88% in 1993 to 1995. By 1996, the world grain carryover stocks, humanity's emergency food supply, had declined 50% from the all-time peak reached in 1987. At the beginning of the 1990s, only a handful of countries, including Canada, the United States, Argentina, the European Union, and Australia, accounted for more than 3/4 of the world's grain resources. Perhaps all these signs will miraculously disappear. If not, how will the world cope? Perhaps the deserts and non-arable dry grasslands can be irrigated to expand agricultural production, but that remedy also has limitations. Too many people already compete for too little water. The aquifers of the world, on which so much agriculture in drier regions depends, are being drained of their groundwater faster than the reserves can be replaced by natural percolation of rainfall and runoff. The Ogallala Aquifer, a principal water source of the central United States, experienced a 3-meter drop through a fifth of its area during the 1980s alone. Now it is half depleted beneath 1 million hectares in Kansas, Texas, and New Mexico. Still worse deficits are building in other countries, and often where they are least affordable. the water table beneath Beijing fell 37 meters between 1965 and 1995. The groundwater reserves of the Arabian Peninsula are expected to be exhausted by 2050. In the meantime, the oil-rich countries there are making up the deficit in part by desalinizing seawater, trading their precious petroleum for water. On a global scale, humanity is pressing the limit, using a quarter of the accessible water released to the atmosphere by evaporation and plant transpiration, and somewhat more than half that available in rivers and other runoff channels. By 2025, 40% of the world's population could be living in countries with chronic water scarcity. New dam construction can add 10% to the runoff capture during the next 30 years, but the treadmill opposing it is unceasing. In the same three decades, the human population is expected to grow by a third. As the land gives out, might we turn to Earth's last frontier, the boundless sea? Unfortunately, no. It is not really boundless, having already given most of what it has to offer. All 17 of the world's oceanic fisheries are being harvested beyond their capacity. Only those in the Indian Ocean have continued to rise in yield, a trend destined to end because the present rate of catch is not sustainable. Several fisheries, including most famously the northwestern Atlantic banks and the Black Sea, have suffered a commercial collapse. The annual world fish catch, after rising fivefold from 1950 to 1990, has leveled off at about 90 million tons. The history of marine fisheries has been one of increasingly efficient mass capture and on-site processing, which increases yield by cutting ever deeper into existing stocks. By the 1990s, proliferating fish farms had taken up part of the slack, adding 20 million tons to the total harvest. But aquaculture, the fin and shell revolution, also has limits. Expanding marine farms preempt the mangrove swamps and other coastal wetland habitats that serve as the spawning grounds for many offshore food fishes. Freshwater farms have more growth potential, but must compete with conventional agriculture for the shrinking supplies of runoff and aquifer-borne water. Meanwhile, in accordance with the general principle of life that all large perturbations are bad, Earth's ability to support the voracious human biomass is becoming even dicier through the acceleration of climatic change. During the past 130 years, the global average temperature has risen by 1 degree Celsius. The signs are now strong. Some atmospheric scientists say conclusive that much of the change is due to carbon dioxide pollution. The connection is the greenhouse effect, in which carbon dioxide, along with methane and a few other gases, work like the glass enclosures used by gardeners. They admit sunlight, but trap the heat generated by it. For the past 160,000 years, as tests of air bubbles in fossil ice show, the concentration of atmospheric carbon dioxide has been tightly correlated with the global average temperature. Now, boosted by combustion of fossil fuels and the destruction of tropical forests, the carbon dioxide concentration stands at 360 parts per million, the highest measure in the 160,000 year period. The idea of climatic warming by human activity has been disputed by several scientists with valid reasons. Atmospheric chemistry and climatic change are both extremely complex subjects. When compounded, they make exact predictions nearly impossible. Nevertheless, trajectories and velocities of the changes can be estimated within broad limits. That has been the goal of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, a group of more than 2,000 scientists working worldwide to assess incoming data and build models of future change with the aid of supercomputers. The more difficult variables they must incorporate include the industrial discharge of sulfate aerosols, which counteract the greenhouse effect of carbon dioxide, together with the long-term capture of carbon dioxide by the ocean, which can throw off calculations of atmospheric change and the tricky idiosyncrasies of local climatic change. Overall, the IPCC scientists have made the following assessment. There will be an additional rise in the global average temperature of 1.0 to 3.5 degrees Celsius, 1.8 to 6.3 degrees Fahrenheit, by the year 2100. Multiple consequences are likely, with few, if any, likely to be pleasant. Thermal expansion of marine waters and the partial breakup of the Antarctic and Greenland ice shelves will raise the sea level by as much as 30 centimeters, 12 inches, causing problems for coastal nations. Kiribati and the Marshall Islands, two small atoll countries in the Western Pacific, risk partial obliteration. Precipitation patterns will change, and most likely as follows. Large increases will be experienced in North Africa, temperate Eurasia and North America, Southeast Asia, and the Pacific coast of South America, and comparable decreases in Australia and most of South America and Southern Africa. Local climates will turn more variable as heat waves increase in frequency. Even a small rise in average temperature results in many more instances of extremely high temperatures. The reason is a purely statistical effect. A small shift in a normal statistical distribution in one direction lifts the former extreme in that direction from near zero to a proportionately far higher number. Thus, to take another example, if the average mathematical ability of the human species were raised 10%, the difference in the mass of people might not be noticeable, but Einstein's would be commonplace. Because clouds and storm centers are generated over marine waters heated above 26 degrees Celsius, tropical cyclones will increase in average frequency. The eastern seaboard of the United States, to select one heavily populated region, will thereby suffer both more heat waves in the spring and more hurricanes in the summer. We can expect the hotter climatic zones to expand toward the north and south poles, with the greatest changes occurring at the highest latitudes. The tundra ecosystems will shrink and may disappear altogether. Agriculture will be affected, in some areas favorably, in others destructively. In general, developing nations can expect to be hit harder than those in the industrialized north. Many natural systems and the species of microorganisms, plants, and animals composing them, unable to adapt to the shift in local conditions or emigrate to newly habitable areas quickly enough, will be extinguished. To summarize the future of resources and climate, the wall toward which humanity is evidently rushing is a shortage not of minerals and energy, but of food and water. The time of arrival at the wall is being shortened by a physical climate growing less congenial. Humankind is like a household living giddily off vanishing capital. Exemptionalists are risking a lot when they advise us, in effect, that life is good and getting better, because look around you, we are still expanding and spending faster. Don't worry about next year. We're such a smart bunch. Something will turn up. It always has. They, and most of the rest of us, have yet to learn the arithmetical riddle of the lily pond. A lily pad is placed in a pond. Each day thereafter, the pad, and then all of its descendants, double. On the 30th day, the pond is covered completely by lily pads, which can grow no more. On which day was the pond half full and half empty? The 29th day. Shall we gamble? Suppose the odds are even that humankind will miss the environmental wall. Better make it 2-1. Pass on through or collide. To bet on safe passage is a terrible choice because the stakes on the table are just about everything. You save some time and energy now by making that choice and not taking action, but if you lose the bet down the line, the cost will be ruinous. In ecology, as in medicine, a false positive diagnosis is an inconvenience, but a false negative diagnosis can be catastrophic. That is why ecologists and doctors don't like to gamble at all, and if they must, it is always on the side of caution. It is a mistake to dismiss a worried ecologist or a worried doctor as an alarmist. At best, an environmental bottleneck is coming in the 21st century. It will cause the unfolding of a new kind of history driven by environmental change, or perhaps an unfolding on a global scale of more of the old kind of history, which saw the collapse of regional civilizations going back to the earliest in history, in northern Mesopotamia and subsequently Egypt, then the Mayan and many others scattered across all the inhabited continents except Australia. People died in large numbers, often horribly. Sometimes they were able to emigrate and displace other people, making them die horribly instead. Archaeologists and historians strive to find the reasons for the collapse of civilizations. They tick off drought, soil exhaustion, overpopulation, and warfare, singly or in some permutation. Their analyses are persuasive. Ecologists add another perspective with this explanation. The populations reached the local carrying capacity where further growth could no longer be sustained with the technology available. At that point, life was often good, especially for the ruling classes, but fragile. A change such as a drought, or depletion of the aquifer, or a ravaging war, then lowered the carrying capacity. The death rate soared and the birth rate fell from malnutrition and disease, until lower and more sustainable population levels were reached. The principle of carrying capacity is illustrated by the recent history of Rwanda, a small and beautiful mountainous land that once rivaled Uganda as the pearl of Central Africa. Until the present century, Rwanda supported only a modest population density. For 500 years, a Tutsi dynasty ruled over a Hutu majority. In 1959, the Hutu revolted, causing many of the Tutsi to flee to neighboring countries. In 1994, the conflict escalated, and Rwandan army units massacred over 500,000 Tutsi and moderate Hutu. Then, an army of the Tutsi, the Rwandan Patriotic Front, struck back, capturing the capital town of Kigali. As the Tutsi advanced across the countryside, 2 million Hutu refugees ran before them, spreading out into Zaire, Tanzania, and Burundi. In 1997, Zaire, newly renamed the Republic of the Congo, forced many of the Hutu refugees back to Rwanda. In the maelstrom, thousands died of starvation and disease. On the surface, it would seem, and was so reported by the media, that the Rwandan catastrophe was ethnic rivalry run amok. That is true only in part. There was a deeper cause, rooted in environment and demography. Between 1950 and 1994, the population of Rwanda, favored by better health care and temporarily improved food supply, more than tripled, from 2.5 million to 8.5 million. In 1992, the country had the highest growth rate in the world, an average of 8 children for every woman. Parturition began early, and generation times were short. But although total food production increased dramatically during this period, it was soon overbalanced by population growth. The average farm size dwindled as plots were divided from one generation to the next. Per capita grain production fell by half from 1960 to the early 1990s. Water was so overdrawn that hydrologists declared Rwanda one of the world's 27 water-scarce countries. The teenage soldiers of the Hutu and Tutsi then set out to solve the population problem in the most direct possible way. Rwanda is a microcosm of the world. War and civil strife have many causes, most not related directly to environmental stress. But in general, overpopulation and the consequent dwindling of available resources are tinder that people pile up around themselves. The mounting anxiety and hardship are translated into enmity, and enmity into moral aggression. Scapegoats are identified, sometimes other political or ethnic groups, sometimes neighboring tribes. The tinder continues to grow, awaiting the odd assassination, territorial incursion, atrocity, or other provocative incident to set it off. Rwanda is the most overpopulated country in Africa. Burundi, its war-torn neighbor, is second. Haiti and El Salvador, two of the chronically most troubled nations of the Western Hemisphere, are also among the most densely populated, exceeded only by 5 tiny island countries of the Caribbean. They are also arguably the most environmentally degraded. Population growth can justly be called the monster on the land. To the extent that it can be tamed, passage through the bottleneck will be easier. Let us suppose that the last of the old reproductive taboos fade, and family planning becomes universal. Suppose further that governments create population policies with the same earnestness they devote to economic and military policies, and that as a result, the global population peaks below 10 billion and starts to decline. With NPG, negative population growth, attained, there are grounds for hope. If not attained, humanity's best efforts will fail, and the bottleneck will close to form a solid wall. Humanity's best efforts will include every technological fix for an overcrowded planet that genius can devise. Endless standby schemes are already on the board. Conversion of nitrogenased petroleum to food is one remote possibility. Algal farms in shallow seas is another. The water crisis might be eased by desalinization of seawater with energy from controlled fusion or fuel cell technology. Perhaps, as polar ice shelves break up from global warming, more fresh water can be drawn from icebergs herded to dry coasts. With a surplus of energy and fresh water, the agricultural revegetation of arid wasteland is attainable. Pulp production can be increased in such recovered lands with wood grass, fast-growing, nitrogen-fixing tree species that can be harvested with giant mowers and then sprout new shoots from the severed stocks. Many such schemes will be tried as demand rises, and a few will succeed. They will be driven by venture capital and government subsidy in the global free market economy. Each advance will reduce the risk of short-term economic calamity. But be careful. Each advance is also a prosthesis, an artificial device dependent on advanced expertise and intense continuing management. Substituted for part of Earth's natural environment, it adds its own long-term risk. Human history can be viewed through the lens of ecology as the accumulation of environmental prostheses. As these man-made procedures thicken and interlock, they enlarge the carrying capacity of the planet. Human beings, being typical organisms in reproductive response, expand to fill the added capacity. The spiral continues. The environment, increasingly rigged and strutted to meet the new demands, turns ever more delicate. It requires constant attention from increasingly sophisticated technology. The ratchet of progress seems irreversible. The message, then, for the primitivists, who dream of nature's balance and Paleolithic serenity, too late. Put away your bow and arrow. Forget the harvest of wild berries. The wilderness has become a threatened nature reserve. The message for the environmentalists and exemptionalists, get together. We must plunge ahead and make the best of it, worried but confident of success. Our hope, well expressed by Hotspur's lines in Henry IV. I tell you, my lord fool, out of this nettle, danger. We pluck this flower, safety. The common aim must be to expand resources and improve the quality of life for as many people as heedless population growth forces upon Earth, and do it with minimal prosthetic dependence. That, in essence, is the ethic of sustainable development. It is the dream that acquired general currency at the Earth Summit, the historic United Nations Conference on Environment and Development, held in June 1992 in Rio de Janeiro. The representatives of 172 nations, including 106 heads of government, met to establish guidelines by which a sustainable world order might be reached. They signed binding conventions on climate change and the protection of biological diversity. They agreed to the 40 non-binding chapters of Agenda 21, offering procedures by which virtually all of the general problems of the environment can be addressed, if not solved. Most of the initiatives were blunted by political squabbles arising from national self-interest, and global cooperation afterward was principally limited to rhetorical exercise on state occasions. The $600 billion additional expenditure recommended to put Agenda 21 into effect, with $125 billion donated to developing countries by industrialized countries, has not been forthcoming. Still, the principle of sustainable development has been generally accepted, an idea previously little more than the dream of an environmentalist elite. By 1996, no fewer than 117 governments had appointed commissions to develop Agenda 21 strategies. In the end, the measure of success of the Earth Summit and all other global initiatives will be the diminishment of the total ecological footprint. As the human population soars toward 8 billion around 2020, the central question will be the area of productive land required on average to provide each person in the world with an acceptable standard of living. From it, the overriding environmental goal is to shrink the ecological footprint to a level that can be sustained by Earth's fragile environment. Much of the technology required to reach that goal can be summarized in two concepts. Decarbonization is the shift from the burning of coal, petroleum, and wood to essentially unlimited, environmentally light energy sources such as fuel cells, nuclear fusion, and solar and wind power. Dematerialization, the second concept, is the reduction in bulk of hardware and the energy it consumes. All the microchips in the world, to take the most encouraging contemporary example, can be fitted into the room that housed the Harvard Mark I electromagnetic computer at the dawn of the information revolution. The single greatest intellectual obstacle to environmental realism, as opposed to practical difficulty, is the myopia of most professional economists. In Chapter 9, I described the insular nature of neoclassical economic theory. Its models, while elegant cabinet specimens of applied mathematics, largely ignore human behavior as understood by contemporary psychology and biology. Lacking such a foundation, the conclusions often describe abstract worlds that do not exist. The flaw is especially noticeable in microeconomics, which treats the patterns of choices made by individual consumers. The weakness of economics is most worrisome, however, in its general failure to incorporate the environment. After the Earth Summit, and after veritable encyclopedias of data compiled by scientists and resource experts, have shown clearly the dangerous trends of population size and planetary health, the most influential economists still make recommendations as though there is no environment. Their assessments read like the annual reports of successful brokerage firms. Here, for example, is Frederick Hugh, head of the World Economic Forum's competitiveness research team, explaining the conclusions of the forum's influential Global Competitiveness Report 1996. Short of military conquest, economic growth is the only viable means for a country to sustain increases in national wealth and living standards. An economy is internationally competitive if it performs strongly in three general areas: abundant productive inputs such as capital, labor, infrastructure, and technology; optimal economic policies such as low taxes, little interference, and free trade and sound market institutions such as the rule of law and the protection of property rights. This prescription, resonant with the hard-headed pragmatism expected in an economics journal, is true for medium-term growth of individual nations. It is surely the best policy to recommend during the next two decades for Russia. Competitiveness index -2.36, and Brazil -1.73, if they wish to catch up with the United States, +1.34, and Singapore +2.19. No one can seriously question that a better quality of life for everyone is the unimpeachable universal goal of humanity. Free trade, the rule of law, and sound market practices are the proven means to attain it. But the next two decades will also see the global population leap from 6 to 8 billion, mostly among the poorest nations. That interval will witness water and arable soil running out, forests being stripped, and coastal habitats used up. The planet is already in a precarious state. What will happen as giant China, competitiveness index -0.68, strives to overtake little Taiwan, +0.96, and the other Asian tigers? We tend to forget, and economists are reluctant to stress, that economic miracles are not endogenous. They occur most often when countries consume not only their own material resources, including oil, timber, water, and agricultural produce, but those of other countries as well. And now, the globalization of commerce, accelerated by technology and the liquidity of paper assets, has made the mass transfer of material assets far easier. The wood products of Japan are the destroyed forests of tropical Asia, the fuel of Europe, the dwindling petroleum reserves of the Middle East. In national balance sheets, economists seldom use full cost accounting, which includes the loss of natural resources. A country can cut down all its trees, mine out its most profitable minerals, exhaust its fisheries, erode most of its soil, draw down its underground water, and count all the proceeds as income and none of the depletion as cost. It can pollute the environment and promote policies that crowd its populace into urban slums without charging the result to overhead. Full cost accounting is gaining some credibility within the councils of economists and the finance ministers that they advise. Ecological economics, a new subdiscipline, has been formed to put a green thumb on the invisible hand of economics. But it is still only marginally influential. Competitive indexes and gross domestic products, GDPs, remain seductive, not to be messed up in conventional economic theory by adding the tricky complexities of environment and social cost. The time has come for economists and business leaders who so haughtily pride themselves as masters of the real world to acknowledge the existence of the real, real world. New indicators of progress are needed to monitor the economy, wherein the natural world and human well-being, not just economic production, are awarded full measure. To the same end, I count it paramount and feel obliged to plead that the new reckoning include a powerful conservation ethic. We hope, surely we must believe, that our species will emerge from the environmental bottleneck in better condition than we entered. But there is another responsibility to meet as we make the passage, preserving the creation by taking as much of the rest of life with us as possible. Biological diversity, or biodiversity for short, the full sweep from ecosystems to species within the ecosystems, thence to genes within the species, is in trouble. Mass extinctions are commonplace, especially in tropical regions where most of the biodiversity occurs. Among the more recent are more than half the exclusively freshwater fishes of peninsular Asia, half of the 14 birds of the Philippine island of Cebu, and more than 90 plant species growing on a single mountain ridge in Ecuador. In the United States, an estimated 1% of all species have been extinguished. Another 32% are imperiled. Conservation experts, responding to what they now perceive as a crisis, have in the past 3 decades broadened their focus from the panda, tiger, and other charismatic animals to include entire habitats whose destruction endangers the existence of many species. Familiar hotspots of this kind in the United States include the mountain forests of Hawaii, the coastal heath of Southern California, and the sandy uplands of Central Florida. Arguably, the nations with the most hotspots in the world are Ecuador, Madagascar, and the Philippines. Each of these countries has lost 2/3 or more of its biologically rich rainforest, and the remainder is under continuing assault. The logic of conservation experts in addressing the issue is simple. By concentrating conservation efforts on such areas, the largest amount of biodiversity can be saved at the lowest economic cost. If the effort is also made part of the political process during regional planning, the rescue of biodiversity can also gain the widest possible public support. It is notoriously difficult to estimate the overall rate of extinction, but biologists, by using several indirect methods of analysis, generally agree that on the land at least, species are vanishing at a rate 100 to 1,000 times faster than before the arrival of Homo sapiens. Tropical rainforests are the site of most of the known damage. Although they cover only 6% of the land surface, they contain more than half the species of plants and animals of the entire world. The rate of clearing and burning of the surviving rainforests averaged about 1% a year through the 1980s and into the 1990s, an area about equal to the entire country of Ireland. That magnitude of habitat loss means that each year, 0.25% or more of the forest species are doomed to immediate or early extinction. How much does the rate translate into absolute numbers? If there are 10 million species in the still mostly unexplored forests, which some scientists think possible, the annual loss is in the tens of thousands. Even if there are a mere 1 million species, the loss is still in the thousands. These projections are based on the known relationships between the area of a given natural habitat and the number of species able to live for indefinite periods within it. Such projections may, in fact, be on the low side. The outright elimination of habitat, the easiest factor to measure, is the leading cause of extinction. But the introduction of aggressive exotic species and the diseases they carry come close behind in destructiveness, followed, in turn, by the overharvesting of native species. All these factors work together in a complex manner. When asked which ones cause the extinction of any particular species, biologists are likely to give the Murder on the Orient Express answer. They all did it. A common sequence in tropical countries starts with the building of roads into wilderness, such as those cut across Brazil's Amazonian state of Rondônia during the 1970s and 80s. Land-seeking settlers pour in, clear the forest on both sides of the road, pollute the streams, introduce alien plants and animals, and hunt wildlife for extra food. Many native species become rare, and some disappear entirely. The soil wears out within several years, and the settlers cut and burn their way deeper into the forest. The ongoing loss of biodiversity is the greatest since the end of the Mesozoic era, 65 million years ago. At that time, by current scientific consensus, the impact of one or more giant meteorites darkened the atmosphere, altered much of Earth's climate, and extinguished the dinosaurs. Thus began the next stage of evolution, the Cenozoic era, or Age of Mammals. The extinction spasm we are now inflicting can be moderated if we so choose. Otherwise, the next century will see the closing of the Cenozoic era and a new one characterized not by new life forms, but by biological impoverishment. It might appropriately be called the Ermozoic era, the age of loneliness. I have found during many years of studying biological diversity that people commonly respond to evidence of species extinction by entering three stages of denial. The first is simply, why worry? Extinction is natural. Species have been dying out through more than 3 billion years of life's history without permanent harm to the biosphere. Evolution has always replaced extinct species with new ones. All these statements are true, but with a terrible twist. Following the Mesozoic spasm, and after each of the four greatest previous spasms spaced over the earlier 350 million years, evolution required about 10 million years to restore the pre-disaster levels of diversity. Faced with a waiting time that long, and aware that we inflicted so much damage in a single lifetime, our descendants are going to be, how best to say it, peeved? Entering the second stage of denial, people commonly ask, why do we need so many species anyway? Why care? Especially since the vast majority are bugs, weeds, and fungi. It is easy to dismiss the creepy crawlies of the world, forgetting that less than a century ago, before the rise of the modern conservation movement, native birds and mammals around the world were treated with the same callow indifference. Now the value of the little things in the natural world has become compellingly clear. Recent experimental studies on whole ecosystems support what ecologists have long suspected. The more species that live in an ecosystem, the higher its productivity and the greater its ability to withstand drought and other kinds of environmental stress. Since we depend on functioning ecosystems to cleanse our water, enrich our soil, and create the very air we breathe, biodiversity is clearly not something to discard carelessly. Each species is a masterpiece of evolution, offering a vast source of useful scientific knowledge because it is so thoroughly adapted to the environment in which it lives. Species alive today are thousands to millions of years old. Their genes, having been tested by adversity over so many generations, engineer a staggeringly complex array of biochemical devices to aid the survival and reproduction of the organisms carrying them. This is why, in addition to creating a habitable environment for humankind, wild species are the source of products that help sustain our lives. Not the least of these amenities are pharmaceuticals. More than 40% of all medicinals dispensed by pharmacies in the United States are substances originally extracted from plants, animals, fungi, and microorganisms. Aspirin, for example, the most widely used medicine in the world, was derived from salicylic acid, which in turn was discovered in a species of meadowsweet. Yet only a fraction of the species, probably fewer than 1%, have been examined for natural products that might serve as medicines. There is a critical need to press the search for new antibiotics and anti-malarial agents. These substances, most commonly used today, are growing less effective as disease organisms acquire genetic resistance to the drugs. The universal Staphylococcus bacterium, for example, has recently reemerged as a potentially lethal pathogen, and the microorganism that causes pneumonia is growing progressively more dangerous. Medical researchers are locked in an arms race with the rapidly evolving pathogens that is certain to grow more intense. They are obliged to turn to a broader array of wild species in order to acquire new weapons of medicine in the 21st century. Even when all this much is granted, the third stage of denial emerges. Why rush to save all the species right now? Why not keep live specimens in zoos and botanical gardens and return them to the wild later? The grim truth is that all the zoos in the world today can sustain a maximum of only 2,000 species of mammals, birds, reptiles, and amphibians out of 24,000 known to exist. The world's botanical gardens would be even more overwhelmed by the 250,000 plant species. These refuges are invaluable in helping to save a few endangered species. So is freezing embryos in liquid nitrogen. But such measures cannot come close to solving the problem as a whole. To add to the difficulty, no one has yet devised a safe harbor for the legion of insects, fungi, and other ecologically vital small organisms. Even if all that were accomplished, and scientists prepared to return species to independence, the ecosystems in which many lived would no longer exist. Raw land does not suffice. Pandas and tigers, for example, cannot survive in abandoned rice paddies. Can the natural ecosystems be reconstituted by just putting all the species back together again? The feat is at the present time impossible. at least for communities as complex as rainforests. The order of difficulty, as I described it in Chapter 5, is comparable to that of creating a living cell from molecules, or an organism from living cells. In order to visualize the scope of the problem more concretely, imagine that the last remnant of rainforest in a small tropical country is about to be drowned beneath the rising lake of a hydroelectric project. An unknown number of plant and animal species found nowhere else in the world will disappear beneath the waters. Nothing can be done. The electric power is needed. Local political leaders are adamant. People come first. In the final, desperate months, a team of biologists scrambles to save the fauna and flora. Their assignment is the following. Collect samples of all the species quickly before the dam is closed. Maintain the species in zoos, gardens, and laboratory cultures, or else deep freeze embryos bred from them in liquid nitrogen. Then bring the species back together and resynthesize the community on new ground. The state of the art is such that biologists cannot accomplish such a task, not if thousands of them came with a $1 billion budget. They cannot even imagine how to do it. In the forest patch live legions of life forms, perhaps 300 species of birds, 500 butterflies, 200 ants, 50,000 beetles, 1,000 trees, 5,000 fungi, tens of thousands of bacteria, and so on down the long roster of major groups. In many of the groups, a large minority of the species are new to science, their properties wholly unknown. Each species occupies a precise niche, demanding a certain place, an exact microclimate, particular nutrients, and temperature and humidity cycles by which the sequential phases of the life cycles are timed. Many of the species are locked in symbiosis with other species and cannot survive unless arrayed with their partners in the correct configurations. Thus, even if the biologists pulled off the taxonomic equivalent of the Manhattan Project, sorting and preserving cultures of all the species, they could not then put the community back together again. Such a task anywhere in the world is like unscrambling an egg with a pair of spoons. Eventually, perhaps in decades, it can be done. But for the present, the biology of the microorganisms needed to reanimate the soil is mostly unknown. The pollinators of most of the flowers and the correct timing of their appearance can only be guessed. The assembly rules, the sequence in which species must be allowed to colonize in order to coexist indefinitely, are still largely in the realm of theory. In this matter, the opinion of biologists and conservationists is virtually unanimous. The only way to save the creation with existing knowledge is to maintain it in natural ecosystems. Considering how rapidly such habitats are shrinking, even that straightforward solution will be a daunting task. Somehow, humanity must find a way to squeeze through the bottleneck without destroying the environments on which the rest of life depends. The legacy of the Enlightenment is the belief that entirely on our own, we can know, and in knowing, understand, and in understanding, choose wisely. That self-confidence has risen with the exponential growth of scientific knowledge, which is being woven into an increasingly full explanatory web of cause and effect. In the course of the enterprise, we have learned a great deal about ourselves as a species. We now better understand where humanity came from and what it is. Homo sapiens, like the rest of life, was self-assembled. So here we are, no one having guided us to this condition, no one looking over our shoulder, our future entirely up to us. Human autonomy having thus been recognized, we should now feel more disposed to reflect on where we wish to go. In such an endeavor, it is not enough to say that history unfolds by processes too complex for reductionistic analysis. That is the white flag of the secular intellectual, the lazy modernist equivalent of the will of God. On the other hand, it is too early to speak seriously of ultimate goals, such as perfect green-belted cities and robot expeditions to the nearest stars. It is enough to get Homo sapiens settled down and happy before we wreck the planet. A great deal of serious thinking is needed to navigate the decades immediately ahead. We are gaining in our ability to identify options in the political economy most likely to be ruinous. We have begun to probe the foundations of human nature, revealing what people intrinsically most need and why. We are entering a new era of existentialism, not the old absurdist existentialism of Kierkegaard and Sartre, giving complete autonomy to the individual, but the concept that only unified learning, universally shared, makes accurate foresight and wise choice possible. In the course of all of it, we are learning the fundamental principle that ethics is everything. Human social existence, unlike animal sociality, is based on the genetic propensity to form long-term contracts that evolve by culture into moral precepts and law. The rules of contract formation were not given to humanity from above, nor did they emerge randomly in the mechanics of the brain. They evolved over tens or hundreds of millennia because they conferred upon the genes prescribing them survival and the opportunity to be represented in future generations. We are not errant children who occasionally sin by disobeying instructions from outside our species. We are adults who have discovered which covenants are necessary for survival, and we have accepted the necessity of securing them by sacred oath. The search for consilience might seem at first to imprison creativity. The opposite is true. A united system of knowledge is the surest means of identifying the still unexplored domains of reality. It provides a clear map of what is known, and it frames the most productive questions for future inquiry. Historians of science often observe that asking the right question is more important than producing the right answer. The right answer to a trivial question is also trivial. But the right question, even when insoluble in exact form, is a guide to major discovery. And so it will ever be in the future excursions of science and imaginative flights of the arts. I believe that in the process of locating new avenues of creative thought, we will also arrive at an existential conservatism. It is worth asking repeatedly, where are our deepest roots? We are, it seems, old world, catarrhine primates, brilliant emergent animals, defined genetically by our unique origins, blessed by our newfound biological genius, and secure in our homeland if we wish to make it so. What does it all mean? This is what it all means. To the extent that we depend on prosthetic devices to keep ourselves and the biosphere alive, we will render everything fragile. To the extent that we banish the rest of life, we will impoverish our own species for all time. And if we should surrender our genetic nature to machine-aided ratiocination, and our ethics and art and our very meaning to a habit of careless discursion in the name of progress, imagining ourselves godlike and absolved from our ancient heritage, we will become nothing. This is Jonathan Hogan. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Consilience, The Unity of Knowledge by Edward O. Wilson. This program was directed by Mae Wuthrich, executive producer Linda Korn. Text copyright 1998 by Edward O. Wilson. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.